Hey everybody, this is The Takeaway for May 12th, that's a Thursday, here in 2016.
This is The Takeaway, I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Listening to an enthusiastic voice urging young women to jump into the world of startups and the freedom of running your own business.
First things first, go for it. Go for it, despite whatever. If you want it, you can do it. Go for it, aim for the stars. Do not think of failure as the first thing. If you fail, 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 but keep trying.
In her mid-20s, Price Mahoza runs a popular nightclub in Kigali, Rwanda, KGL. Rwanda, her wide-eyed face says, is the land of opportunity.
We need people who understand what they are doing, so the investment in that area is very important. So the strength of partnership, therefore, is very key.
Rwandan President Paul Kagame also thinks his country is a land of opportunity, although he would extend that to all of Africa, speaking there at the 26th World Economic Forum on Africa. It's the first time that Rwanda has been given the opportunity to serve as the host country. It's a chance to show how far the country's come from the dark days of 1994. Rwanda was torn apart, you'll recall, as an estimated 800,000 people were massacred by Hutu extremists in 100 days. Today, Rwanda is a success story under the leadership of President Paul Kagame. Can the good news continue, and is Rwanda's success translatable around the whole of Africa? Joining me now from Kigali is Yinka Adegoke, Africa editor for Quartz, who's in Kigali covering the World Economic Forum, and Josh Ruxin, American author of 1,000 Hills to Heaven, Love, Hope at a Restaurant in Rwanda. He and his wife run Heaven Restaurant in Kigali. Yinka, what's the message Rwanda wants to give the rest of the world?
So Kigali, just like Rwanda, wants to show the world that it's a world-class city and it's able to hold world-class events. It has been doing so over the last couple of years. It's a concerted strategy by the government to become a business conference hub for East Africa, and they don't get much bigger than the World Economic Forum.
Josh Ruxin, is Kigali and Rwanda's success story translatable to the rest of Africa, do you think, or is there something very special about this country?
Well, my wife and I moved here 10 years ago, in great part motivated by the aspirations of this nation and of the government. And when I visit places like Uganda and Kenya, they're somewhat jealous of how far Rwanda has come with so little. And so I think the big hope with the World Economic Forum and other events and venues is not just putting Rwanda on the map, but also putting its version of progress on the map, essentially. If Rwanda can progress with infrastructure, with technology, with jobs, with tourism, then there's no excuse for the rest of the continent.
Yinka, what's an example of successful technology that's been installed and is in use in Rwanda and Kigali nowadays?
They built out a broadband network. The government sort of implemented in partnership with South Korean telecoms company, and they see this as an important strategy to them being able to compete on a global basis.
Josh Ruxin, will Paul Kagame essentially punt away the success by grabbing too much power, taking a third term, essentially becoming a kind of democratic dictator?
I think no one can argue with the success of President Kagame's administration. I mean, the country has come so far for the average Rwandan in the last 22 years that it's very hard for anyone here to argue with progress.
Although, Yinka, is a third term perfectly fine that we're just used to as two terms in the United States?
There has been huge progress in this country, but there is always the concern that you can have too much of a good thing. For the United States in particular, this is a difficult one because they've been a great aid donor and supporter of the government. But at the same time, what they have to take into account is that just right next door, the Burundian president is trying to go for a third term, and that's causing all kinds of potential problems there. On the other side, you have Democratic Republic of Congo has the same issue and with an unpopular president. So it's fine for one president, but I guess the U.S. can't be seen to play favorites.
Josh Ruxin, why doesn't economic success cross the border more successfully from Rwanda into Burundi that's having so many problems right now?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, as was pointed out, Rwanda is very much at the epicenter of a number of challenges for the region. My hope, of course, is the reverse will happen, that Rwanda will shine a light on all the opportunities for these other countries that suffer from a lack of security, a lack of leadership, and, of course, horrible corruption.
Looking at Africa now as a continent, what regions are awaiting the kinds of success that Rwanda is having right now? Yinka?
The story of this conference has been in the run-up to this year, since the start of the year, commodity prices have been on the downslide. This has meant the economic forecast for the continent has been cut. Most of the discussion here has been around how this is more of an opportunity for the whole continent to stop relying on commodities, stop relying on just selling raw materials, and to start thinking about diversifying their economies, you know, to add value.
Get away from natural resources and the commodities market that's so subject to boom and bust. Josh Ruxin, speaking of a business that has nothing to do with commodities, how's life in heaven?
Life in heaven is quite good, especially this week. We were lucky enough last night to host Tony Blair and the Power Africa group that came in. So it's been extremely busy at Heaven Restaurant, which is the restaurant my wife, of course, built from the ground up here. If the restaurant business is any indicator of the direction Rwanda is going, then Rwanda is heading in the right direction, because we've just seen a massive influx of tourists, of business tourists, guerrilla tourists, and others coming through our doors at a higher and higher level year on year.
Well, an invitation there to have lunch or dinner with Josh Ruxin. He's the American author of A Thousand Hills to Heaven, Love, Hope, and a Restaurant in Rwanda. His wife built the restaurant Heaven in Kigali. That's what he's talking about there. Open for business today. Josh, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
And Yinka Adegoke, thank you so much. He's the Africa editor for Quartz. Talk to you again.
Thank you very much.
A warning now from Nigerian-born writer Adewale Ajadi about the seduction of technology and people who talk about transforming Africa by importing its future.
We never industrialized, so we don't have that social engineering thinking. And what it leads to is that we exclude the majority of our people in the design of the future.
Ajadi spoke to us last year. Our next guest, though, Adero Davis, is sensitive to that charge of excluding people. She is co-founder of Poap Post, a startup in Kenya. Her company is a parcel delivery app that connects drivers with people who need things delivered all over a smartphone. The aim is to get mail to some of the remotest places in Kenya for a set price and on time, and that's something the Kenyan Post Office simply doesn't do. Adero Davis, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello. Thank you, John, for having me here today.
So you are sensitive to this issue of excluding people in the investments of new businesses and new industries inside Africa, right?
Yes, very much so. Poapost, we came up with the idea because of the lack of efficient parcel delivery to rural communities, which is obviously not urban city centers where a lot of people focus, and that's where majority of funds do go. So in initiating our project, that's exactly what we do. We start from the bottom up.
So you address those issues with an app, with an army of drivers who are already working inside Kenya?
Yes. So we created an app that we just tested in March in Kenya, a small pilot. And basically a person just taps on the app. The geolocation pretty much picks up where they are, since there's no formal address system in Kenya, especially in rural areas. And then the nearest courier receives the message, goes to the home, picks it up, delivers it to the next destination. So we hire locally because there are no addresses. And so that particular courier knows that area very well. So they can just have a pinpoint, even though on the back end we're using longitude and latitude. And we realized when we were there, like, we have to teach, you know, map reading and just fluency with using and downloading apps in and of itself with the local communities, because we started in a very small neighborhood, Joska in Machakos County in Kenya, which is about an hour and a half away from Nairobi proper. It was challenging because we just really believe that it can work, because we tested it and we're like, oh, wow, it's working, you know? After, you know, it was just kind of crazy. But Africa, it's just the region in general is just people, like, the corruption and You kind of worry about government, and you're like, okay, how do we do this in a manner so that we do not irritate you know, particular governments, and they may try to shut us down and things of that nature. So we're trying to do it in a very respectful way, not necessarily do like a behavior change per se, but just bring new information to the people and say, hey, you really don't have to carry that jug of water on your head for 5 miles. Like, we can do this for you and we'll make it affordable.
But your challenge is selling to investors.
Yes.
This is an opportunity.
Yes.
Selling what you believe.
Yes.
Inside, and that you see.
Yes.
In the people you talk to with the water jugs on their head.
Yes, exactly. That's the most frustrating part, because you're like, I see it. You know, we had like 46 requests in one day after our pre-launch party. And to give some context, there's a startup here in New York called Postmates, which pretty much does the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. And they had like at least $500,000 worth of funding. And when they launched with $500,000, they were getting like one request per day. And which is, you know, and we had like ours cost $10,000 of our own money that we saved. And we were able, you know, to get like close to 100 downloads in 5 days, 46 requests in one day. So it's like to do the comparison and to see and say, oh, we're scared. I'm like, the demand is there. They're using it. And this is with people who did not have as much knowledge. We had to do a lot of manual onboarding, explaining how to download an app, because a lot of people do have mobile phones, and the penetration has been insane just from us going there for 6 times in a year, where we're seeing feature phones, and then we're on a Matatsu and people have iPhones, you know, but they have it for a status symbol. So it was like, oh, we thought they weren't going to trust us. That's not the issue. The issue is they don't know how to use this thing.
What's your, you know, a year from now, should we check in with you? 2 years from now?
Yeah, a year from now, check in with us. You know, we're still chugging along and we're focusing on, you know, finalizing the product. And we have some very, you know, new me is an accelerator, is very interested in us and is keeps checking in like, where are you? So we're positive.
Co-founder of Poa Post, a startup in Kenya to deliver packages outside of the postal network and outside of the pre-existing Western shipping services that are very, very expensive. Darrow Davis, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, John.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. The slow wheels of accountability in Brazil have finally dislodged President Dilma Rousseff from power. The vote wasn't even close, 55-22. There are a range of charges, but central to these proceedings is the accusation that the president borrowed from state banks to cover up large budget deficits in the Treasury. Rousseff will be suspended for up to 6 months and replaced by her former ally, Vice President Michel Temer. Joining me now is Bruce Douglas, Brazil correspondent for Latin American newsletters. Bruce, what does suspension mean?
So this means the president is now removed from power for a period of up to 180 days. She's expected to address the nation later today, and then she will be removed from power while Michel Temer, her vice president, takes over. He's expected to nominate his cabinet today, and he will, to all intents and purposes, be president until the Senate makes a final decision on whether or not to remove Dilma Rousseff.
So the suspension still leaves the question of permanent removal up in the air, is what you're saying?
Yes, this is not the end of the process. There is little speculation that Dilma Rousseff is going to resign, even though some of the opposition are now calling for her to do just that. She has given all indication that she is going to fight to the very end of this process. So we could see months of instability ahead. There is a possibility that she may even attempt to form some kind of parallel government with close allies to respond to all the moves that the government by Michel Temer makes.
Temer is in the same party as Rousseff, yes?
No, they were in the same government, but he's actually from a different party. And he's going to be pursuing policies which are very different, it looks like, from those of Dilma Rousseff. Dilma Rousseff was from the Workers' Party, as was her predecessor, Lula da Silva. They helped to drag millions of people out of poverty and bolstered Brazil's middle classes. But many of their efforts were via state benefits, and Michel Temer has promised to curtail some of those benefits in order to tackle Brazil's budget deficit. And he's also keen to privatize a lot of Brazil's infrastructure. So his government promises to be quite a radical departure from that of Dilma Rousseff.
Can he effectively rule? He's a minority party, right?
This is the million-dollar question. The question is whether all those people, the majority who voted for Dilma Rousseff to be suspended, the question is whether they will support Michel Temer. And at the moment, it looks like he's going to get a fair win from the media that here in Brazil is remarkably hostile to Rousseff. But the question is whether these politicians will support his policies, particularly if he embarks on controversial measures such as tax raising or limiting government spending, which he may have to do to address Brazil's serious economic issues.
Is the Senate now going to conduct a full-scale public trial of Rousseff, and will all of the charges be aired in a very public and, I presume, very ugly way?
Yes, they will be, but this process has been going on for a long time. We've already had sessions on Dilma Rousseff's impeachment in Congress and in the Senate. So this process will continue, but it will be, of course, a significant trial. It will be something which gradually, I suspect, loses the attention and focus of Brazil's public and its media, while they focus more, perhaps, on the Temer government. Now, the legal question that Dilma Rousseff is being tried over may also become secondary to the political pressures against her. And it's possible that this trial, actually, the legal basis, may be secondary to the political pressure that is building against her.
Bruce Douglas, Brazil correspondent for Latin American Newsletters. He spoke with us from Rio de Janeiro. Bruce, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a brain training program, performance can be compared with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Hillary Clinton under fire.
I would like us to go into those files and hopefully make as much of that public as possible. If there's nothing there, let's tell people there's nothing there.
What if there is something there?
Well, if there is something there, unless it's a, you know, threat to national security, I think we ought to share it with the public.
Hillary Clinton on Jimmy Kimmel last March. She's not talking about her email files or secret reports about the Benghazi raid in Libya. She's talking about UFOs. The Clintons have actually shown an interest in this subject. In 1997, then-President Bill Clinton released files related to the Roswell incident. The conclusion? No aliens were found at the site. Bill Clinton's former chief of staff, John Podesta, now Hillary Clinton's campaign chairman, has urged Washington officials to reveal the truth about the unexplained regarding UFOs. Is this a campaign issue? You decide. When Bernie Sanders was asked by a UFO enthusiast if he believed extraterrestrials exist, he said, "I've met many. I see them in Washington all the time." Donald Trump has remained silent on the subject. Chase Kletsky has investigated UFOs, strange creatures, and the paranormal for over 20 years. She's a former deputy director of investigations and star team manager for the Mutual UFO Network. Chase Kletsky, welcome to The Takeaway.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's such a pleasure.
What's the scariest thing you've been told about a government secret that involves extraterrestrials?
Probably a quote from Ben Rich, former CEO of Lockheed Martin Skunk Works. He literally said, "We already have the means to travel among the stars, but these technologies are locked up in black projects, and it would take an act of God to ever get them out to the benefit of humanity. Anything you can imagine, we already know how to do." And the reason I find that scary is if they're so advanced in their technology and the American people, the world population has so little information where our tax dollars are going, we're in trouble.
And living out in the Southwest, you see things in the sky. Could that be just because there are a lot of military bases around there and they're testing out strange new airplanes?
Absolutely. There is the drones are another big factor in this. But, you know, you have R&D, especially out in that area. There's a lot of R&D going on, research and development, a lot of testing type sites like Area 51. But, you know, almost all the bases there are using unmanned aerial vehicles. And whether these are unmanned helicopters, surveillance drones, the technology in unmanned vehicles right now is warp speed. It is warp speed. And they're coming out with the most incredible behavioral objects. So it's making our job a little more difficult than it was back in the 50s when there were less things to, you know, consider when you're given a report by very credible people. And when I say credible people, the disinformation that we find the media likes to put out about us is that, you know, we're all running around the woods, you know, with you know, country folk looking for UFOs. And the reality is we're talking to astronauts and military members and high-ranking government officials. That's who my witnesses are.
What would change if the files were opened and there was UFO evidence? What would change?
Well, if the files were open, I don't believe that will happen. Can you imagine? First of all, you know, every 24-hour news agency would – that's all they talk about for a month. Every UFO investigator would be interviewed by somebody, and they would constantly – but there's so much behind what has happened to witnesses, and, you know, it's such a big issue. They can't afford to let this out. They can't afford to tell the American people or the whole world that they knew about this. They just can't.
Chase Kletsky has investigated UFOs, strange creatures, and the paranormal for over 20 years. Deputy Director of Investigations and Star Team Manager, she once was for the Mutual UFO Network. Take care.
Thanks.
Troy from St. Paul. My father was known in the neighborhood to have a meticulous lawn. It was green. It was soft. One morning we woke up in the backyard and there was about a 60-foot yellow circle burned. Perfect. The grass is matted down, and there wasn't a soul around that could figure out what happened. Somebody put that there. Something landed. I don't know what it is, but X-Files, help me out.
877-8-MY-TAKE. The fantasy UFO premise of the famous Ender's Stories imagined that video games could sort out minds and pick who could save the universe from an evil invasion. And they actually do it in the movie Ender's Game.
Bad luck.
Who authorized his access to this?
I did.
Try again, little mouse.
To what end?
Not every battle can be won, Hiram. The way he plays the game reveals his state of mind. If you won't let me assess him one-on-one, I need some other way to know what he's feeling.
This video game, with sounds but no language, attempts to sort out minds in a very different, deeper way. And it's real. A game developed to test memory is imagined as a data collection tool to see if patterns of memory loss can be found that might eventually diagnose the early onset of dementia. The video game is called Sea Hero Quest, and it's developed in part by dementia researcher Michael Hornberger. The game has already been downloaded over 600,000 times since its release last Wednesday, and Hornberger says by working around language, the game reaches deeper into the brain.
Many of the classical tests to test dementia have been developed in, I would say, in Western Europe or North America, and very often we find that they don't apply maybe worldwide. It's very difficult to translate them into different languages. So what we realized, spatial navigation is such an intuitive thing which really people can play anywhere. So the least language we're using to diagnose dementia, the better it is in a way, because we can easily apply them across very different cultures, different countries. And of course, we can also make the comparisons to potentially to animal research.
In this case, what kinds of triggers and symptoms and details are and patterns are you looking for that could be predictive, you know, 10 years in the future? I suspect it'll take you that long to get this kind of data.
So we have very different things we're looking at in the game. For example, how you use maps, how you use landmarks, how you use what we call dead reckoning. So how you, this is the flair level in our game, how you kind of orientate yourself back where you started from.
So if your ability to read a map, your ability to grasp and internalize a map, and then your ability to use that data to orient yourself in space is degraded, so far that is a suspicious sign that maybe you are a candidate for dementia?
Well, yeah, this is what we're really trying to find out. Now, I should say, so if you are in unfamiliar places, of course, you get lost. Everybody gets lost. What we find with dementia, it's more that if you're in very highly familiar places or environments, so for example, you're going down to the shop you've been going down for many, many years, and you turn the wrong way on the street corner, that's a very worrying sign. Or we have many patients who even get lost in their own house and can't find anymore where, for example, the bathroom is. that is a very worrying sign where people, if they're worried, they should really see their doctor and really discuss it with them. Now, in unfamiliar environments, it's very, very different. And there are certain situations which are extremely confusing, even for healthy people. And I'm talking also about myself. So like multi-story car parks, extremely confusing. And even if you're healthy, you get lost and can't find your car. And the other example, I guess, is very big supermarkets. So it's a good way, in a way, of experiencing how many dementia patients feel, even in environments they know for a long time.
What kind of a population do you think is possible to study with something like this without having the data degraded in some way?
Well, it depends. So we will have, of course, we have to see who is going to play the game. And this is one challenge, in a way, using gaming for science, that you use the general population. So we don't have control over which different ages are playing it. We're hoping that by making the game very casual, that we will get a large spread of people from, of course, younger age to an older age. But we really have to see what comes out. The good thing is, if you collect data on such a big sample, so at the moment over 600,000 people worldwide have downloaded the game, you, even if a very, very small percentage of people are of a certain age group, you will have still hundreds of people who have played the game.
Would it be possible for you to have people play the game casually, and if they score in an alarming way, you could notify them that they need to see a healthcare professional?
Theoretically, yes, it's possible. For the future, what we more envisage is that maybe we can extract certain features of the game, which then clinicians could use in their dementia clinics to diagnose people earlier. If you would make it like available as a diagnostic tool for the general public, as I said, it would be very, very problematic because it could have all kinds of implications for insurance reasons and so on.
What was it like working with the gaming folks?
It was actually a fantastic experience we had, but it had a lot of challenges, obviously, because we wanted to create a game that was casual and fun, but at the same time scientifically valid. So very often the gamers would say, well, you can't do that. It would be a really boring game. And other times we would say, no, we can't do this because then the science wouldn't really work. So it was a kind of evolving process, which was fascinating in a way of giving us an insight and also how gaming really works and getting people engaged and motivated. While, you know, a lot of our research, of course, lab-based research, it's quite, you know, they're quite boring tasks to do. So it taught us a lot, and the gaming people are taught a lot about the science behind it.
How early onset do you have to come up with a credible detection to be of value to clinicians?
Yes, so this is a very controversial topic at the moment. So many studies worldwide are looking at this, and you can 5 to 10 years before actually any clinical symptoms are present, the disease might be already really starting to happen at quite a fast pace. This is really what we think at the moment, that there's such a big emphasis on memory is a bit of a problem, because when we age, our memory, everybody's memory gets worse. So memory slips are very often very common to happen. So we think via the navigation, this might be a different angle, because it's very unusual for people, of course, to get lost in a way in an everyday environment. So with this game and the findings from the game, we can hopefully create tests which are very sensitive and very specific to getting lost very early on. And hopefully that would be a long time already before usually people will present now at the moment in the clinics.
Michael Hornberger, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Michael Hornberger is professor of dementia research at the University of East Anglia. He is co-creator of Sea Hero Quest, a mobile game that could help detect early signs of dementia.
I came back down from the housetop and went to my house. Then an old lady came to me and asked me all kinds of questions.
I was shooting birds, surrounded by sunflowers as big as evergreen trees. But then these big men came and fought for the birds, taking them all.
And she had a book and a pencil.
I was in Europe touring a bombed-out city, and the city must have been Paris because some of the buildings I had seen in Life magazine.
And she wrote down everything I said.
All this fighting I dreamed.
I looked at her and started to laugh at her and said, "Give me your book. And let me read what you wrote down."
I noticed the city was somehow now located in a valley.
I looked at this woman close, and it was my mother.
And the houses were tumbling down, 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 down.
Imagine finding a buried archive from more than a half century ago that contained the inner life of the people of a lost civilization, their thoughts, their desires, their dreams, thoughts collected by an eccentric psychologist, Bert Kaplan, and his team. Back in the 1950s, Kaplan wanted to study human dreams in a systematic way. He created a catalog of millions and millions of note cards filled with text documenting answers to Rorschach tests, descriptions of dreams and life histories, mostly from Native American and non-European participants. Harvard professor Rebecca Lemoff came across Kaplan's box in the Library of Congress. It had sat unopened for 50 years like a spooky accidental time capsule. Lemoff is a professor of the history of science at Harvard University and wrote the book A Database of Dreams about Kaplan's work and the deeper impulse to record everything about humanity in a single database.
I was studying the history of this very ambitious filing cabinet that was started at Yale in the 1930s, and it was meant to contain all essential data on all people in the world. What I noticed in the footnotes is that there was a mention of an even more ambitious but elusive database where they had tried to gather everything that had been left out of this seemingly total filing cabinet, and that was what I came to call the Database of Dreams. It was meant to collect all the subjective elements of human experience that couldn't be easily pigeonholed.
And, I mean, the first category isn't easy to pigeonhole itself. what kinds of things were they collecting in the first instance, and then how did they make the leap to weird stuff that we have no category for?
Right. The first one interested me because they were very systematic about trying to collect data or information about every human and also non-human activity that took place in a culture. So they were systematic in ranging from even flora and fauna to rituals of death. But they were mostly shared cultural information, and they aspired to gather all the data of 10% of societies that had ever existed. And they, by the mid-1960s, they had over 65 million index cards.
And what did they think they would have at the end of all of this?
What they expressed was that they wanted a kind of at your fingertips, a machine that would provide people's dreams at the touch of a button.
And why do you think this was kept?
It was never thrown away because it suddenly just was so irrelevant. And it lapsed into a state of what I call suspended animation, where it was neither destroyed nor preserved, but sort of just lapsed.
When you say it became irrelevant, how so? Is it a format, or was it more deeply found to be irrelevant?
Well, for one thing, the format, you know, lost out in the great sort of the Betamax versus
right.
VCR of its day. So microcard lost out. But more deeply, the paradigm of social science that they were operating under came to seem problematic by the 60s with the civil rights movement, with decolonization. So because most of the data they actually did collect came from American Indians, and it was sort of a global reach of what they called non-literate people, which wasn't actually always true. But in many ways, they were imagining and watching people as they were contacted by the dominant society and were changed by it. So their data reflected this kind of journey or acculturation. But later that paradigm itself came under attack. For example, on an island that was occupied by the U.S. Navy, some anthropologists would come along and take the Rorschach test of everyone on the island.
Inkblots, right.
Inkblots, exactly. And
what must they have thought?
Yeah, and sometimes that intrudes into the record. So there'll be a question by the person who's taking the test, like, what good does this do my people? Or sometimes they had never even seen a two-dimensional picture before, much less an inkblot, which was supposed to be universal. So in many ways, the kind of cracks in their research design revealed themselves.
Thinking about this project now, in light of the big data and the ways in which we have access to, on a huge scale, data about people, how do you compare them?
Yeah, that's really what this project was about for me, was to try to engage in that kind of comparison, because I think it's often missing from the conversation about big data. And a kind of bumper sticker phrase I like to use comes from the 1973 sci-fi thriller Soylent Green, which is
yes, I remember.
I adapt it to say, instead of Soylent Green is people, big data is people. And I think the way it's often described is as if it was this kind of cold, hard, inhumane data, when in fact it's our most intimate actions and our baby photos being massively uploaded. I think we're all dealing today with the kind of crisis that Kaplan and his team were pioneers of.
You know, we talk a lot about data for the election, and, you know, the way in which people voted in Rhode Island for the Republican candidates is something of huge import today, but it's completely meaningless and worthless and useless tomorrow. But 100 years from today, 200 years from today, 1,000 years from today, if you were to stumble upon a box that contained, you know, all the conversations of people at Best Buy, you know, ordinary, irrelevant moments of human life, you would think you had stumbled on something so unbelievably valuable in terms of its insight into the people who lived then.
I think that's true. I mean, I think it's a good reminder. That's the kind of thing that exactly the kind of thing that became interesting. There was an example of a sociologist in 1947 who was part of this project. He formed a what he called the Oskaloosa Day Station in Kansas, where he studied everyday life, and he recorded things like a boy putting on his socks at 7:01 in the morning in October. And that's preserved. When you pull the data up again, it does look like a lost literary treasure in a way that you wouldn't otherwise have been able to access, except that they were saved by this kind of quixotic process.
Did you just sit and search through it for hours and just look at random stuff?
I did, and I was constantly stumbling upon the most unlikely, beautiful things that I never would have come across otherwise. There was one of that was preserved of a Navajo man who had just come back from World War II, and he'd come back to his village, and he was remembering being sent abroad. He had been sent to Little Stockton in England, where he would bicycle to work every day and have tea. And then he described, you know, when the war was over, they flew him over concentration camps, and he was in the street when people were jitterbugging naked. And it's a point of view that otherwise is eclipsed. That's sort of just the dailiness of even the things we now file under major world events.
It also reminds us that, you know, the history that we get, the story that we're told about what happens is so one channel. And reality is infinite channels at infinite time, you know, in infinite dimensions.
Yeah, that's a beautiful way of putting it.
Which certainly makes it hard to write a grant, I suppose.
For them or for me.
Rebecca Lemoff, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Rebecca Lemoff is a professor of the history of science at Harvard University, author of Database of Dreams. To see pictures of some of Kaplan's note cards, you can head to thetakeaway.org. And here's something to take with you today. Got to hand it to Oculus and Samsung. Samsung has sold its millionth virtual reality setup, Gear VR. The technology licensed from Oculus is trying to make the leap from CSIC University Lab prototypes of virtual reality to a real consumer platform for apps and games and movies. People on the Oculus platform can have access to more than 250 game apps and movie-like recorded experiences. That's right, in the future, you'll be able to post your experience. Not just the picture, the whole experience. You want to see my wedding pictures? No. See my wedding. The whole thing. That's right. Thanks for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.